I think, why we actually have that kind of cavalier or nonchalant attitude toward conversation is that we don't really realize how critical conversation is to our human existence and to co-creating the future. I was really struck the first time I read a quote by an evolutionary biologist, and this guy really blew my mind. He was talking about, his name is Umberto Maturana, and he lives in Chile. And he said, our human existence is one in which we can live whatever world we bring about in our conversations, even if it is a world that finally destroys us as the kind of being that we are.
Humanity is in trouble. Some of us are here to help. Together, we will take the next step.
Welcome to the Next Step Podcast. I am your host, Jared Sanchez, and this is now the fifth episode of the Next Step Podcast entitled The World Cafe. My guest today will be Juanita Brown, and we will be discussing her co-discovery of the World Cafe dialogue process. Before I get into that, I just want to take a moment or two to just give a couple of little updates about what's going on with the show. When the last episode aired with Charles Eisenstein, it had already been after a sort of unexpected hiatus that I swore wouldn't happen again, and alas, here it is, over 1 month later, and I'm finally getting the next episode out. Now, basically, without going into the many details of my day-to-day life, things are extremely chaotic for me right now, in a way that makes doing these creative projects very difficult, actually. Basically, I will no longer speak of any goals for upcoming shows that I don't already have recorded and in the editing phase. I think it's only fair to you, the listening audience, that I don't induce you into a Pavlovian salivating response of eager anticipation for the next episode, because you know that's how it is. Just kidding. But seriously, though, I think it's only fair for me to only speak about the shows that I know will be out soon, because I have them under the belt, so to speak. Alright, so then after this next round of shows is aired, it probably will be another indefinite hiatus, although I'm sure it'll be much shorter than 5 or 6 weeks. But again, I don't want to get ahead of myself, and just plan on the next few weeks having some regular output from me, at least. I appreciate the fact that, you know, with only one appearance on another podcast, which was KMO's The Sea Realm podcast, and no actual advertising work done on my part, I do still get about 150 to 200 people who listen to each new episode as they're aired. And, you know, that's really exciting, actually, to me. I mean, it's very small numbers compared to Fox or any of that crap. But, you know, on the one hand, it gives me a certain amount of joy that people are, in fact, listening. And on the other hand, I also kind of want to start feeling like I have an obligation to keep the episodes coming. And while the idea is nice in theory, despite any amount of happiness you listeners bring to my life, there's just no way I can even come close to sticking to any sort of regular schedule with this show, so I hope you can understand that. I just consider this to be a natural expression, and as such, I attempt to have as few guidelines and boxes as possible. Even though the format of these episodes are pretty much have been similar, you know, with a little intro and music in between the interview. Once I start having a little bit more time to really spend on the production of these, you know, you'll start to hear some pretty interesting things on the show. And who knows? I'm getting ahead of myself, but I want to say thank you to all the listeners who have been with me, and well, hello and welcome to all new listeners. Let's get on with the show so that all you new listeners don't get bored of hearing me blabber on. And, Juanita Brown, the founder of Whole Systems Associates, collaborates as a thinking partner and design advisor to create and host forums for constructive dialogue on critical organizational and societal issues. With her partner David Isaacs, Juanita is the co-originator of the World Cafe, an innovative approach to large group dialogue which is rapidly spreading throughout the U.S., Canada, Europe, Latin America, Africa, and the Pacific Rim. The World Cafe is being used in a growing number of community, corporate, governmental, health, educational, NGO, and church settings to access a higher collective intelligence in situations of entrenched conflict. That's very interesting to me. Juanita served as a senior affiliate at the MIT Sloan School's Organizational Learning Center, where she participated as a member of the core team of the center's Dialogue Project, one of the early research initiatives in this field. She has also served as an associate with the Norwegian Center for Leadership Development, a research affiliate with the Institute for the Future, and as program faculty at the John F. Kennedy University School of Management, California Institute of Integral Studies, Columbia University, and the University of Monterrey, Mexico. She is a fellow of the World Business Academy and has been honored in the world's who's who of business and professional women. It's quite a bio, and I'm just pulling that right off the internet, and to be perfectly honest, between me and you, I had no idea about any of this before reading that. I had no idea Juanita was... she's been quite busy, and she's had a wonderful career, and I'll tell you what, this is a great interview, and I've been really excited to get her on the show for a long time. About a year ago, it was when I got a review copy of her book from the publisher, Barrett Kohler, and it's finally now come into fruition, and it's... in ways that you don't understand is literally a dream come true. So with that being said, I will get right into the interview. Enjoy. I've seen the arc shake from your pneumonic tongue, but the braille that you weave of itself, it shall read aloud. Yes, it will. I said, she's falling, she's still falling, but no one wants to come. She's crawling, she's still crawling on your burial ground. Said, she's falling, she's still falling, but no one wants to come. Said, she's crawling, she's still crawling on your burial
ground. Tell the audience, Juanita, what is a conversation that matters?
Well, I think if any person looks back at their own life at a time when a conversation made a difference, when it was something that you were very interested in, that you cared about, that really connected to something that was important to you, those are conversations that matter. And perhaps not only important to you, but important to the others who are in the conversation as well. So I don't think it's a fancy definition. It's more like what counts, talking about what counts.
As opposed to just saying, hey, did you hear about the pirate ship rescue story on the news? It's going beyond that normal, banal chatter that most people know about.
Exactly. It goes beyond just talk. To what really counts, to what really matters to us and our lives and our families. It could be so many different things depending on, you know, who you are and the life situation you're in and the issues you're facing, both individually or collectively in a community. But a conversation that matters, you can tell in your own heart because your interest stays in it. Your excitement is there. Your curiosity is there when you're exploring that. You don't want to just walk out and say, oh, gee, I have to go somewhere else right now. You want to be there for it. You don't want to miss it.
Yeah, it is a very simple idea, but at the same time, I think it is necessary to have that sort of, you know, differentiation between the kinds of conversation because we don't really make that distinction very often in life. You know, we'll have great conversations in my experience, but people don't say, they might say, oh, that was a great conversation, but they don't say, hey, let's have more of those. It's just, that's just part of people talking, you know, the way people look at it. But
well, I completely agree. And one of the reasons I think why we actually have that kind of cavalier or nonchalant attitude toward conversation is that we don't really realize how critical conversation is to our human existence and to co-creating the future. I was really struck the first time I read a quote by an evolutionary biologist, and this guy really blew my mind. He was talking about, his name is Umberto Maturana, and he lives in Chile. And he said, our human existence is one in which we can live whatever world we bring about in our conversations, even if it is a world that finally destroys us as the kind of being that we are. Indeed, this has been our history since our origin as languaging beings, a history or the creation of new domains of existence as different networks of conversation. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that's true. Everything we do as human beings, we do in conversation. Look at you and I right now. You know, we're creating meaning together through language. And that is one of the core faculties that we have as human beings. And that's how we bring new things into being. You know, you and I are talking together and we say, oh, why don't we try that? You know, yeah. And everything we see in the, quote, real world around us is actually the result of people who have made meaning together and have coordinated their actions in conversation. So there's no real difference between talk and action. We live in conversation. And when I realized that and realized that conversation was actually a co-evolutionary force, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this really needs to be my own life work, because I'd been a child of the 60s, you know, and I really believed in serious, you know, social change and at the time, revolutionary change, I must say. And yet I now realize that all great ideas for positive change also begin in conversation, as well as ideas for horrible things, you know, that are destructive. Yeah. And if we know how powerful our conversations really are in creating everything around us, you know, whether it's our feeling tone or whether it's actually something like building a house, you know, then we can be more choiceful about how we participate in those conversations. You know,
yeah, I definitely see that. And I've had that same, you know, perception that it is what we talk about. And, you know, there's a lot of the Dawkins and Dennis that say we are meme creators. You know, that is what separates us from the natural world, is this ability to create these ideas that can then take on a life of their own. And that then shapes the world. And when I started thinking like that, then I look around and I see just potential. You know, whereas most people who don't have this perspective, they just see, you know, this is the world the way it is. You know, I'm just going along with it and doing this and that. But when you can shift your perspective to this idea that, no, it's the way we talk together and the way we think together, that's what creates this reality we share. Then it's like, wow, it opens all doors. You know, all possibilities are there. And it's just amazing and frustrating. Amazing and amazingly frustrating. Because if you're the only one in your little podunk town in Illinois who sees that, you know, and it's like, well, okay, well, there's the bar.
And yet, to us, the spread of the World Cafe and this whole thrust in dialogue and in conversation, and I think, is a result of more and more people, the excitement and recognition that more and more people are having around the world, that there is a difference we can make by the conversations we have. and mm-hmm. by the choices we make and the thoughts that arise in those conversations and the collective intelligence that we can build around critical issues if we engage in focused, intentional, heartfelt conversations focused on the things that most matter to us at whatever level of system, you know, from the level of a family to a local community, to government, to NGOs, etc. So we're very, I actually have to say, I grew up as a social change person, and I feel more hopeful today, even though I don't know the outcome, you know, because I think we are on the brink in some difficult ways. But I also think we're waking up at the same time to these very fundamental ideas that you were pointing to, and recognizing that we do have a choice, and that the way systems evolve is through gazillions of choices made by ordinary people. And,
yeah.
you know, the World Cafe as a way of hosting dialogue in both small and large groups, which was discovered by accident, I might say, in our living room.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to kind of go in that direction if we could. This World Cafe process isn't exactly something that you and your partner, David Isaacs, who you co-wrote the book with, you didn't sit down with a pen and paper and say, how can we create a process that will really, you know, kick everybody's butt and get things going. It was actually kind of serendipitously discovered. And if you could just kind of maybe go through that story real quick.
Cerebral cortex as your thought, your understanding of my words. Telepathy frequency exists. It's just that the carrier wave is small mouth noises. All so-called primitive people know that the world is made of language, that you sing it into existence, that what you say it is what it is, that it is maintained in existence by an act of rational apprehension.
It was actually kind of serendipitously discovered. And if you could just kind of maybe go through that story real quick.
Yeah, this was an amazing experience for us, really. We have a house on the side of a mountain in Northern California where we hosted a lot of what in those days we were calling strategic dialogues. This was 15 years ago. And we had a group from a number of different countries. The topic was a thing that we were working on, a cross-disciplinary thing that had to do with knowledge and knowledge management and that kind of thing. But what happened was it was raining outside, and we couldn't put people out on the patio. And normally we would have started with a dialogue circle. We had 24 people in our living room, and David said to me, "Oh, well, why don't we just put up our little TV tables, and everybody can eat their breakfast inside, and then we'll, you know, get everybody to put away their tables, and we'll start in our normal kind of dialogue circle." We had been doing research on dialogue at the MIT Dialogue Project at the time, and I said, "Oh, that sounds like a good idea." So we put up the TV tables and our graphic recorder. We have an artist. We often work with what are called graphic recorders, who help to with pictures. Some of your listeners might be really interested in it. It's in pictures and icons and words help to map the conversation as it happens. Well, our graphic recorder came in and she looked at those TV tables and she says, "Oh, you know, I think those TV tables, they need some tablecloths." So she takes off the easel sheets, you know, from those like chart pads, and she puts them onto the tablecloth, onto the little TV tables. And then I walk up there and I said, "Hey, this is looking kind of cute. I think I'll put some flowers on the table." And then she is working around putting up her stuff, and she said, "Oh my gosh, this is starting to look like a cafe. I think I'll put some little markers on the tables, you know, like the crayons that sometimes you see in regular cafes." Kind of like doodle on the napkins. Well, she did that, and she wrote a little sign on the door that said, "Welcome to the Homestead Cafe." Our house is on a dirt road, and it's called Homestead. And so she puts the sign on, and people walk in the door, and you could see it was like, "Oh, a cafe. Great." And they went, and they got their little breakfast and their coffee, and we noticed that as they were sitting talking with each other, this was the second day of this dialogue. It was about knowledge and leadership. It was something related to leadership, if I recall. And we noticed that they were starting to draw on their tablecloths, and everybody was like totally, you know, hunched over looking at the drawings that were evolving on the tablecloths. And David and I said, "Wow, I don't think we should start the meeting. This is the meeting." And
that's awesome.
Yeah, and so we just said to people, keep on talking about what's been bubbling up in relation to the theme that we were describing, and in a little while we'll get together. Well, after about 30 or 40 minutes of people continuing, someone raised their hand in the meeting and said, "Hey, I'd like to know what's going on at the other tables. Why don't we leave one host at the table and send," they were little tables of four, "send the other three people at the table traveling to three new tables," right? Carrying the ideas from the first conversation into three new conversations. And if I'm the host at the table, I'm receiving three new people who have been in three other different conversations than I have, right? And then the host at the table shared what had happened in their conversations, and the new people coming in started, we noticed, to link and build from the conversations they were in. So think about it as kind of like tinker toys of the collective mind, you know? And after about another half an hour, 40 minutes, someone said, "Hey, why don't we leave a new host at the table and send the rest of them traveling?" So it was kind of like a musical chairs, sort of, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
But tablecloths kept holding the essential ideas that were evolving in the middle of the room in a certain way. I mean, at all these different conversations. Well, what was happening was that we were totally by accident, we didn't realize this till afterwards, we were increasing the density of connections in an emergent way.
Yes.
You know, around a critical question. What is the relationship between between leadership and intellectual capital, or leadership and knowledge development? Well, and it was a question that everybody cared about in that room because they were focused on that in their work and stuff. Well, by the third round, the room was like lifting off its rafters. We were shocked at the amount of energy and creativity and excitement that was going on in that room. And I realized, oh my goodness, we're coming up on noon already. 3 hours had passed, and it had happened in a second. So we kind of called a pause. We asked people to put their tablecloths. We put a great big roll of paper in the middle of the room, and people put their tablecloths around the edges of this large mural roll, and we took a tour of the tablecloths, everybody, around the room. And then our graphic recorder, we began to do reflections. What were the patterns or the insights or deeper questions that came out of that collective conversation? And we were amazed at the quality, the new ideas, the innovative insights, the possibilities for action in this new field that was developing, that later came to be called, for those of you who work in organizations, knowledge management or knowledge capture, not knowledge sharing. And we knew right then that something unusual had happened. We didn't know exactly what. And after that, we sat down, and after that dialogue was over, with a friend of ours from Denmark who had been staying with us and was part of the dialogue, to try to understand what had happened. And what we realized over time, I mean, later we did a lot of research on this. I mean, it began to spread. Several of us went to take this pattern of the cross-pollination of insights, you know, people moving from table to table, or ideas moving from one place to the other in a whole variety of ways in a conversation, seeding conversations like this. We began to experiment, because there were people there from various parts of the world. So one guy went back to Latin America, two or three went back to Scandinavia. We began to work in the U.S., both in corporate and in community settings, experimenting with what we had discovered. And right then, we called it the World Cafe. Right in the beginning, our friend Finn from Denmark said, you know, I really think there's something here that could be of world service. I think we should call it the World Cafe. And that sounded like, oh yeah, that's a great name. But all of this happened by accident, you know? And we then began to experiment. And Jarrett, it was amazing how it began to spread from place to place. We then began to host at large conferences these kinds of cafe dialogues. And that pattern, it then dawned on us, that was, all of this was a big learning experience. It dawned on us that the pattern that we saw in our living room with 24 people and 6 tables of people moving from place to place, carrying the seed ideas from one conversation into the next, was actually a basic pattern that our human ancestors had actually followed. You know, when the town crier comes to tell the news, or when tribes, you know, went traveling and took the news of their tribe to other tribes, that this was a basic human pattern, and that the cafe table was like the ancient idea of the circle in an intimate way, and that we were actually beginning to tap into a possibility for how to develop new and creative ideas in relation to critical issues that we were facing, whether it be at the community level or in an organization or in a government or in an NGO or in a village in Africa. And over these last 15 years, the World Cafe has spread into an incredible global dialogue movement. So I'm just, I have to say I'm very humbled by what has happened with this work. We never anticipated it, and I feel like because we did not create it by our intention, our formal intention, and we felt that it was a gift, really, that had arrived in a completely unexpected way, that it was our responsibility to share that gift in an open source way. And so we decided we were not going to make it proprietary or own it, that we were going to make this a gift and our contribution to positive social change for whomever might be able to make use of it.
That's so great, and that's the one of the things that I just love about being human is that these things can just come up from the unconscious, whether it be like the personal unconscious, you know, or like the collective unconscious, and it just takes that right, you know, luck, that right sense of magic, and you know, ideas click together, and then you have this new thing that's created by all of these little sparks, these individual sparks of magic, you know, and you could never predict that. You could never ever say, I think this is where we're going to be headed with this, you know. It's just one of those things that you have to just allow to come up. The process has to unfold, and then you can look back and, like you said, reflect and see what's there, and just, that's just a great story. I think I just get a buzz from, you know, hearing that. I mean, it had to have been so energetic being in that room for that first time and just saying, what is this?
Right, exactly. You know? And your use of the word magic is not an accident, because we later came to call that phenomenon of collective intelligence. You know, if you're in a conversation and it's really, you can just feel when something new is starting to happen and new ideas are coming up and everybody's really excited and they're really paying attention. We came to call that the magic in the middle. And that when magics connect, that's when we really see the potential for positive change. And we have been amazed at where this has gone around the world, you know, from the UN to the nation of Singapore to Japan to, I mean, we just started a new online community, which is now you younger members here will probably know what this is. It's a Ning site for the World Cafe. And we've just started the new online community using that approach to social networking. And I cannot believe where people are signing in from Kabul, Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from India, from China, from South America, from South Africa, from Australia, I mean, from Vietnam. I mean, I'm just like blown away, I have to tell you, and very touched, because I do feel like the younger generation who knows how to move both face-to-face processes, but also this whole social networking possibility, I think that this is what's giving me hope. This combination of how our most ancient ways of relating to each other, face-to-face, in conversation, experiencing the magic, can now also be, in some significant ways, you can have those same feelings about people who are all across the world through these new social networking tools. And I was not a big computer person. I have to admit it. I wasn't. I resisted this because I'm from that generation, you know, that really wasn't as comfortable with that. But I am so impressed with what some of the younger leaders are doing around the world, both in this face-to-face work and in, you know, the combination with online, bringing large groups together, because we can now have global conversations around questions that matter.
Yeah.
And that's exciting to me.
Yeah, definitely. There, I mean, for instance, we wouldn't be having this conversation for more than one reason. For the reason of, you know, the service that we're using, you know, there is a little bit on the internet side that I have to attend with. But also just discovering this whole process never would have happened for me in the way that it has had it not been for the internet. And then here we are.
And if you think the internet is a wonderful metaphor for the World Cafe, so think about this. Imagine, so one thing is the World Cafe, let's call it as a process, right, that you can design to work with a group of most any size from 12 to 1,200. Like this week, there's a congregation that's having a cafe that they're that's for 5,000 people. The democracy movement in Thailand has hosted a cafe with 10,000 people. The Girl Scouts with 7,000. So we haven't found actually a limit to size as long as people can see the question, you know?
Wow, that is amazing.
So one thing
those are large numbers.
Large numbers. So one thing is the process of the World Cafe. The other is the design principles that underpin it. And we discovered over with our research that there were seven core principles that if you use those principles, whether you use a formal cafe process with cafe tables and writing on the tablecloths and all that or not, you will tend to have a more life-affirming conversation, right? We can talk about those in a minute. But then there's this deeper pattern that we were talking about, the network pattern, because what the World Cafe does, and this is where it connects to the larger metaphor, where if you create a network of conversations, you can think of any group that is in conversation about things that are life-affirming around the world as being at tables of the World Cafe, just like they are at tables in a room, so that people can feel connected like they do on the internet. Think about how many, if you think about it from a metaphorical point of view, how many millions of tables at the World Cafe, or what we would call the World as Cafe, are actually existing. The numbers of conversations that are going on using these new tools on behalf of positive things, it's astounding.
It
and
is.
How so many other people can connect into those and add their voice. It's very, very encouraging.
The potential, again, like I said, looking around and just seeing the potential. I have this way of looking at things sometimes. I like to call it the microscope view, whereas I can kind of focus down to, okay, my town here in Illinois. If I were in some way able to, you know, begin the process of the cafe here in my town and other people here catch on, and then that spreads through around here, and then if I can pull the microscope up a little and see, okay, in my county, if the county, on the county level, people started using this process.
Exactly.
Wow, and then pull the microscope up. Let's talk about the state, you know? Wow. Let's go even further. And then you just see that network. I mean, the potential is just, what would happen, you know? what would happen if 30% of the planet caught on to this and was able to use this effectively in their worlds, in their own private little microscope worlds? I mean, it's just...
Exactly, and you're grasping, Jarrett, exactly the fundamental dynamic of large-scale systems change. There's an architect by the name and philosopher by the name of Christopher Alexander. He wrote an amazing book called The Timeless Way of Building. It's one of those books that if I was only on a desert island, you know, I would take that book with me because it's made such a difference in my life. And what he says that life-enhancing improvements actually co-evolve not from grand plans or edicts from a central authority, but from small acts of collaboration based on a repetition of life-affirming patterns. He says, every act helps to repair some larger, older hole. But the repair not only patches it, it also modifies it, it transforms it, it sets it on the road to becoming something else entirely new. And he shows in his works how millions of these tiny transformations carried out locally in any living system can spread their effects to transform the system as a whole. And what you just said about your town and then your county and then your, you know, state and then connecting the states, well, this is actually happening in various parts of the world. So, for example, in the nation of Singapore, they began with 15 people from different government agencies learning about the World Cafe. They then went back to their own agencies and began hosting cafes. A number of those agencies worked out in communities. They began to host conversations in those communities.
Wow.
And now the nation of Singapore is becoming a cafe nation, a more dialogic nation, you know, a much more participatory place. That also began to happen in Denmark, and we're seeing it in city dialogue. So, for example, the city of Dresden, they held 12 simultaneous cafes, this was 2 years ago, on all different aspects of the life of the city. And then they held another whole set in Bilbao, Spain. Well, now the European Union has picked it up. And they're... Yeah, it's just astounding. And now they're beginning to work with the whole European Union. So, you know, exactly the pattern, Jarrett. I appreciate so much what you said, because all big changes start small. So people should not feel like they can't do anything. You would be amazed at what is possible. Think about it. We started with 24 people in our living room. And look what's happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's.
And we had no money. This has not been a financial thing. Everybody except for their part-time assistant and one part-time net person who gives full-time for her minimal 10 hours that she supported to help do this. This entire thing has spread by volunteers all over the world. This is not a big organization. The World Cafe is not a formal organization in any way.
That's great. I love that about it. And, you know, the idea that anybody could just pick this up and run with it. And also that, you know, you guys haven't, you get it. So I'm going to just say that you get it. And so you're not trying to turn this into like a money-making empire, which so many good ideas just seem to run into that problem.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, you should be supported, and I will encourage everybody to donate and do what they can, but you're not trying to, from the top down, say, well, you know, this is the direction this whole movement's going to go.
Well, please do encourage people to contribute. The way that we have actually helped all the, you know, like if people come together, we try to help, you know, if particularly our younger members, one of the things that we're very committed to in the World Cafe is to becoming a learning laboratory for multi-generational collaboration. And what I mean by that is, you know, traditional ideas of mentoring or the elders teaching the youngers, I think that's a very, I think there are new paradigm ways of thinking about that, where we can truly partner together across the generations around issues that affect our common future. And we at the World Cafe want to become a learning laboratory for how to do that well. And so, you know, bringing our younger members to key gatherings, et cetera, all of that, you know, requires resources. So we've been tithing ourselves, you know, like many people who have helped in the early days of the World Cafe, you know, we contributed 10% of all of our money that we made in the normal economy into what we call the gift economy, which is what the World Cafe is based on. And so we definitely encourage contributions of all kinds, you know, not only financial contributions, but contributions of energy and time and people's different skills. So, you know, those of you who have online skills, please come into the online community. You can go to the website, www.theworldcafe.com, and go to the online community, and it will give you a click there to go into the new social networking site that's just opened up in the last few days. So,
cool, I'm getting you fresh then on that one.
Pardon me?
I said I'm getting you on a fresh point on that one then.
Oh yes, and whatever those of your listeners who would like to come in and contribute to the online community, both with your questions to those who are already experienced hosts, or your own contributions from dialogue experiences you've had that have made a difference, it would be wonderful to have more new members of all ages coming in. Because we're transferring over from the other site. So we're just getting started on this new one.
Huh. Well, that'll be interesting to see how that develops then.
Yeah, it'll be exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely more interested in the face-to-face stuff, but, I mean, you just can't deny the power and potential the Internet holds. So.
Well, I think the social networking, like the Facebook style, and that's sort of what these Ning sites are. It's the more open source way that people are working with those principles from Facebook. I think it's very human. If someone like me, I have to tell you, Jarrett, if someone like me can feel excited about participating in a site like that, and my 88-year-old mom can get on, and every day she's saying to me, oh, you know, somebody sent me a message. I mean, it's really wonderful. Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, the multi-generational aspect of this, we could never have done this without the younger leaders who are a part of the World Cafe community really taking the key leadership and helping that happen, for which I am deeply grateful.
Well, and we were talking beforehand that you had just got back from a conference on multi-generational leadership, and that intrigues me, that whole notion, because I think it's absolutely critical that we connect the generations, because, you know, I'm of the younger generation, and I see the generations even younger than me, and for the large part, they seem quite disconnected from the past and from, you know, the things that have worked in the past, and I don't necessarily consider our current cultural push to be going in a direction of sustainability exactly, and, you know, what will happen when we kind of need some of the older ways, you know, and our generations have spent nothing, no time connecting with them. And I just, in so many ways, I see the value in the connection of generations. There's that idea of the generation gap, which always seemed kind of funny to me, like, I get it. I see why it has occurred. You know, the increase of information and technology in small periods of time, and this and that, the counterculture, whatever. But at the same time, there's just so much value in that connection of the generations that I just don't think it is something that can be left out of all of our conversations, and I think our everyday awarenesses as well.
Well, I think there is mutual learning to be had here, and we have been hosting intergenerational dialogues through the World Cafe since 2004 when we did our first one at the Shambhala Institute, and we thought, that's up in Canada, they have an institute for authentic leadership, and we thought we were going to do maybe 20 people or 30 people as a little learning laboratory, again, what could we learn from this, because nobody was really doing much of that at that time, and we had to cut it off at 100 members and move it to a school gymnasium because so many people wanted to participate. And we had people from age 13 to 90 in that gathering. And I have to say, it was one of the most exciting conversations I've ever been a part of. And I think it's not just about learning from the older generations. I think it's about our learning from each other, because I think the younger generations don't really feel listened to or heard by us of the older generation, you know?
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And no wonder they say, well, forget them. You know, they don't listen to us anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in a period where we need every bit of intelligence we can gather from people of all life experiences in order to solve the issues that we have before us. And I think that young people's voices, who are those who are inheriting, both for the positive and the problematic aspects, you know, from us of the older generations, you know, we need each other. I think that's the bottom line here. I think of ourselves not as different generations, but as a single generation, in a certain way, waking up together to what we're going to need to be doing together to assure our mutual survival on this planet going forward.
Yeah, I can agree with that, because I have two young sons, and they're still very small, not even in school yet, and I learn from them. And it's kind of weird to say that, because, you know, in this culture you think, oh, well, you don't know anything when you're a child, you know. But at the same time, you know so much. It's just not formed in the direction of, you know, earth politics, if you will. You know, and I remember hearing a talk by Timothy Leary one time, and he had talked about, you know, the early days of the computer, and he's like, oh, wow, you know, my kids, they're teaching me. I'm the student now. You know, I'm learning from them. And I just see that, like, all human beings have something to offer. It's like, I'm very big on individuality, you know, and freedom of choice. But at the same time, anybody with eyes to see, you can't help but see that we are just one collective. You know, it's like we are one great intelligence. And like the World Cafe process, connecting these things is really where the magic happens.
Yes, and you know, I think not only the World Cafe, but there are many other, what we would call, process doorways
to this
phenomenon of collective intelligence. And, I mean, I think the World Cafe is one wonderful one, but it's certainly not the only one. And I would very much encourage people to, if you go to our website, you will see links to many other dialogue efforts that are going on around the world and also here in the United States, and links to, for example, Tom Attlee's Collective Intelligence website that really is a huge treasure trove of information on all of these different modalities and ways of working in local communities and in on campuses and et cetera. So right now, for example, a curriculum is being developed. This came out of this recent multi-generational gathering. A curriculum is being developed for young social change leaders using these kinds of process, these new ways that we now know work so well, to bring people together across boundaries so that we're not caught in adversarial ways of activism, but actually can begin to build bridges across differences. And I think that's what some of these new methods help us do.
Yeah, and I hope to have Tom Attlee on the show sometime in the future, because he really opened the doors for me, like I said to you earlier. And I think that's a very important distinction for people to make, that the World Cafe is in itself a form of activism, but it's just not what people think of as activism. Because when people think of activism, they think of, you know, that adversarial thing, that adversarial quality where it's like, oh, we got to fight this injustice, or, you know, we have to raise awareness for this cause. And all that kind of does is pit people against each other, when in reality, what we all really need and want is connection. And social change activism, social process activism, is like this new paradigm that we're talking about here. And it's like a shift in awareness from this us against them to, well, we're all in it together. How are we going to do this together sort of thinking? And it's just a very important distinction, because once I caught on to that, then that was it. You know, there was no turning back.
Well, really, that's actually happened to me as well. I mean, I was an adversarial activist. I worked with Cesar Chavez and the farm workers movement, and even though it was nonviolent activism, there's no question it was the 1960s style activism. And even until, you know, there was a moment, for example, in kind of the recent political time, when, you know, I was so sad and upset about what was happening in the world that I thought, oh my God, the World Cafe is not fast enough. You know, maybe we need to go back into old style, right? Mm-hmm. But then I read a book, which, for those of you who are working in social change. The book was called Hope in the Dark. I'm trying, you just find it by its title on Amazon. And it's a small book. And it was talked a lot about the history of activism and new forms of activism. And I began to realize that the World Cafe, by giving people voice at the grassroots level about the things that are most important to them, and I include the grassroots as being, you know, could be the UN Security Council in a certain way, you know, I mean, at any level of system, by giving people equal voice in a non-hierarchical way around the issues that most concern them, that actually what the World Cafe was contributing to was something I had always believed in, but I didn't know that it could be done in a new kind of way. And that was that I really believed in democracy and democratic voice. And I thought that to achieve real democracy, you know, you had to, like, exercise your rights and, you know, stand up against and like
right.
that, right?
Yeah.
And now, of course, there's a role for that. But I also can see that if we are trying to build collective intelligence around complex issues, whatever that issue might be, from a water, you know, water problems in a local community, you know, where you've got different interests, you know, environmental interests, and then, you know, people defending their land rights and like that kind of thing. You need to have all of those people who have the different lenses on this issue together, able to think together, or we will never solve the kind of critical questions we're facing now. And when I began to realize that, it was like, oh, this is more like a compassionate form of activism, if we want to use that language. I'm not sure I would use the language of activism to describe that. But certainly, social action or social constructive social change, or I would even might call it co-evolutionary change, in the new paradigm. And we've seen some amazing things happen, you know, between Israelis and Palestinians in small ways on critical environmental issues. We're doing now large cafes around global warming. Global warming cafes are happening all around the country, bringing different people together. Because people care about global warming no matter what their political persuasion.
Right.
And they care about future generations. So we're beginning to figure where can we use these new, what I would call social process technologies, like the World Cafe, like Appreciative Inquiry, like Future Search, like Open Space, those are the names of some of them if people are interested, to begin to build collective intelligence. And we now know this stuff works. So we now have, you know, 15 or 20 years of experience in a lot of these methods and have done a lot of research on them. And now it's our opportunity to put them to work at a critical moment in our common history.
And I would say it is critical. And it's amazing that you guys have been doing this work for so long. It's like, I'm just discovering it in the past year and a half or so. And, I mean, it's changed everything about the way I look at the world. You know, definitely have gone from a more stark outlook to a much, much more hopeful and potential reality. I mean, I can't stress enough how much I appreciate the work you guys are doing. Definitely. I mean, I want to say that to the future generations as well, because I know people are going to keep continuing this and it's just going to spread. And it's, again, just so hopeful and potential.
Well, just so that we really welcome others who want to learn more. There are people around the world who are happy to be mentors, you know, I'm not talking about from an age point of view, but mentors for those who want to begin to host in their own communities. We're beginning to develop learning programs for potential hosts. The first one is happening in Atlanta in October. You know, so there's a lot going on that people who want to tie in could have the chance to participate in.
Very nice. All right. Well, Juanita, I think this is probably a good place to leave off. I think this has definitely been a very good introduction for people to understand what this is and to help them make that shift into this new paradigm of thinking and activism and being with other people and communicating. You know, this is, it's just such a different way of thinking, but you know, once people get it, it's obvious, it seems to me. Would you agree?
Well, it's wonderful. It's changed my way of thinking, I can say that.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, going back to that original story, though, I just can't get over that. It's just so, that's just so cool.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
So to your listeners, I would encourage you to go to the website, theworldcafe.com, and that will lead you into a lot of other wonderful directions.
All right. All right. If you can hang on just for another minute. But Juanita Brown, thank you for coming on to the Next Step podcast.
Okay. Be well.